dotted people.
Okay, our next presenter comes highly recommended by Ted Sheldon. His name is Kevin Fontenot, and he's a doctoral student at Tulane University who studied with Bill Malone, and he's writing his dissertation on Jimmy Davis, and he's going to tell us a little bit about Jimmy Davis's Victor recordings.
I've never used one of these pocket pal things, so we'll have to see how it goes. I really want to thank y'all for inviting me to come up here. Nashville is one of the few cities that I leave New Orleans during Jazz Fest to come to. So I'm very happy to be here and to find so many people who are so friendly and also who've heard me speak before. I was shocked at how many people have heard me before. During the break, the lunch break, I took a walk down to the Ryman Auditorium and found this little book, which is a group of quotes from the Reverend Sam Jones. I don't know if any of you know who he was. He was a very famous revivalist from Georgia following the Civil War. And Davis's father may have been named after him. I'm not sure, but his father's name was Sam Jones Davis. But anyway, he... has a quote here on approving laughter in church, and it says, "I'm glad to see such a healthy response in this church. I know now you're not dead. I never can do anything with a dead crowd. It is possible sometimes to get a reformed gambler turned around, and then he goes at a 40-mile gait, but it don't make any difference with a dead man which way he's turned." And I know y'all aren't a dead crowd, so I appreciate that. Initially, I had written a paper on the Victor sessions, and then I got a lot more time. And so I've expanded it to do a broad study of Davis's music in general, from 1928 to his last performance, which was a few weeks ago, I guess. So you're going to get a broader topic than just the Victors, so I hope you will appreciate it. James Houston Davis is, without a doubt, Louisiana's most important contribution to the field of country music, and along with Louis Armstrong, to American popular music in general. Throughout the 30s and 40s, Davis registered hit after hit on the hillbilly charts and saw several of his compositions cross over onto the popular charts as well. His songs, including Nobody's Darling But Mine, You Are My Sunshine, became hits for artists as diverse as Gene Autry, Bing Crosby, Ray Charles, and Satchmo himself, who recorded Davis's version of Hand Me Down My Walking Cane, which he called I'll Get Mine By and By. What it was, we weren't certain it was what he was going to get. Anyway, Davis has been honored with induction into the Country Music Hall of Fame, the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame, the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame. And judging by some of the most recent inductees, I think he deserves induction into the Pioneers wing of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Despite his importance, Davis is yet to garner great attention from the scholarly community. Perhaps this lack of concern is due to Davis's political career. He was governor of Louisiana twice, which some find objectionable. Or to the fact that music scholars find little appealing in an artist who actually made money rather than being abused by the system. Davis, for his part, only reluctantly grants interviews to researchers who express an interest beyond the occasional journalistic foray. More to the point, his career is so lengthy, his catalog so large, his music so diverse, that the task at times seems daunting. For me, it often is. Existing scholarship on Davis can be broken down into three categories. I'm a historian, so I've got to pay a few debts. First, several scholars have written broad general discussions of Davis's life and music. Usually these studies make little effort to connect his career to larger trends in country music history and are often rife with factual errors. A tendency also exists to downplay the governor's rich gospel career. The novelty of a singing politician dominates these accounts, and music scholars find themselves unable to navigate the complicated political bayous of Louisiana. And political historians often fail to take the music seriously. To this group of studies, I would add an attempt to classify Davis's music as Celtic in origin. This is greatly appealing and it's wildly romantic, but anyone who listens to a Davis recording quickly realizes that he owes a deep debt to African-American styles and to popular culture, as well as those Anglo-Celtic traditions from which he comes. Second, scholars have spilled a great deal of ink concerning Davis's early risque recordings. These articles usually focus on the debt he owes to his black sidemen. Davis had an integrated band in the early 30s in Shreveport, Louisiana, which was quite amazing considering that town's reputation. Either that or the, as John Morthland calls it, unbridled carnality of these songs. Seldom do scholars admit that Davis was working in a tradition well known among Southern folk artists, and that the dirty element owes as much to white tradition as to black. Only Nick Toshes approaches the songs with the tongue-in-cheek humor that Davis so obviously saw in them. A third group of research focuses on the origins of Davis's most famous composition, You Are My Sunshine. This song has one of the most complex genealogies in recorded history. And most scholars agree that Davis did not write the song, but merely copyrighted it. I do have a few questions about that, which I'll address in a few minutes. These three areas of investigation fail to reveal the diversity and beauty of Davis's legacy. Scholars have tended to concentrate on the mundane or the controversial. Often, those with the controversial seem to want to wreck his career. The facts remain, however, that had he not recorded a risque line, or had he not given us You Are My Sunshine, the rest of Davis's career and life validates all the honors that have been given to him. Jimmy Davis was born into a musical family. His father, Sam Davis, played a passable fiddle and was in demand for local dances. His repertoire included things like Turkey in the Straw and Arkansas Traveler. His mother, Sarah, sang traditional Southern ballads, usually about death, loneliness, and she had a particular love for social bandits like Jesse James. She also played the harmonica and taught her children religious music. But perhaps the most important person in Davis's musical years, formative, was his paternal grandfather, Henry Cicero Davis. Davis doesn't talk about his grandfather very much, but research I've done shows that he has to be the source of Davis's musical inspiration. A native of Georgia, the elder Davis lived an adventurous life, walking to Arkansas when he was not yet a teenager, winning the hand of his employer's daughter, donning the Southern uniform during the Civil War. But what most people remembered about Davis, Henry Davis, was his remarkable singing voice, a voice that was clear and deeply emotional. He summoned up old Georgia tunes with ease, and his Devil May Care attitude may indicate that he was more than familiar with risque songs such as Keyhole in the Door, which is an ode to voyeurism that Davis later recorded. Henry Davis's exact repertoire is difficult to determine, but it is highly possible that many of the songs, these Georgia songs, that found their way into Jimmy's compositions came from his grandfather. Songs like Columbus Stockade Blues, You Are My Sunshine, and several others all link back to Georgia. All of these can be attributed to someone else who wrote them, but I'm beginning to wonder if there wasn't some sort of a folk tradition that they were a part of that hasn't been fully documented. Jimmy Davis drew influence from the music that surrounded him as a child. Besides the music he heard at home, he heard music at local dances and play parties, traveling circuses, medicine shows, and from neighboring African Americans. Determining the extent of black influence on Davis from direct exposure is difficult. He often denies that there is any such influence. However, he has admitted that he heard black church music, listened to blacks in the field, and that he may have encountered wandering black minstrels like Henry Thomas from Texas. In his film autobiography, Louisiana, which was made while he was governor in the 1940s, Davis even has a fanciful scene where he learns the basics of rhythm from a blacksmith, and the guy is beating out rhythm on the anvil, and it's very fanciful. Davis also heard a black jazz band on a steamboat during his abortive trip to New Orleans in 1919. From what I have been able to determine, it was probably Fate Marable's band, and Louis Armstrong was in that band, so you had a sort of a brief meeting there in 1919. Davis got drunk on this excursion trip and was dancing with a young lady and slipped on the floor and ripped her dress off. Or at least it's the story he told me. And at any rate, he decided to leave New Orleans after that and come back to Quitman. I've never gotten the full story, but what I have heard is pretty humorous. The place Jimmy learned the most about music and the power his singing potentially could command was in the local church. Singing instructors from East Texas periodically came to Quitman and the surrounding area to teach shape note singing and basic harmony. These singing schools provided Jimmy with his first formal musical education and introduced him to the use of choruses to drive home the idea of a song. They also established a deep and abiding affection for religious music, an affection that would later lead him in pioneering some gospel recordings in the 50s. But his decision to pursue music came at one of these camp meetings near Quitman. There he heard a former named Dale Grissom do a solo, and he was so moved that he decided he wanted to do the same thing. He went and spoke to Grissom, and Grissom said, "You have a nice voice, and maybe you should try to sing." He said, "My singing wasn't all that bad, and maybe he ought to sing some more Davis." A major change in Davis's music came when he attended Louisiana College in the early 20s. At the college located in Pineville, which is my alma mater as well, Jimmy received formal voice training, was a member of the boys' vocal quartet in the choir. He also belonged to a quartet called the Wildcat Four, which specialized in popular tunes. Davis continued to sing in glee clubs and quartets when he received his master's degree at LSU, which is very interesting. He received a master's degree in educational psychology, and the title of the thesis was Comparative Intelligence of Whites, Blacks, and Mulattoes. And after 13 pages of detailed analysis and many misspelled words, he comes to the conclusion that intelligence increases in direct proportion to the whiteness of a person's blood. He did not like this to be known after he had written this and when he later on in his career. But this was one of many studies done at LSU at the time that validated this type of thing based on the scholarship of the time. It didn't take into account many factors. But I do think that his education, the background he has, does affect his stance in the 1960s as a segregationist, because he was educated not only at home in racism, but in college and in graduate school. And this hasn't been taken into account before. Anyway, while he was at Louisiana College and in Baton Rouge at LSU, he sang on the street corners and began to make actually enough money to pay his college debt. So he did fairly well there. Despite his high degree of education, Jimmy seems never to have learned to read or write music. He did develop his own system of writing music, which is something of a shape note style. And he would write out a piece and then he would bring it to one of his friends, for example, Charlie Mitchell, who would then translate it into proper notation. He also seems to be a fairly bad guitarist, which is why he never accompanied himself. His true genius, however, lie in associating himself with fine musicians who could interpret and complement his style. College also exposed Jimmy to the final and perhaps most important influence on his career after Henry Davis, recorded popular and hillbilly music. The record industry was only beginning to boom when Davis entered college in 1921, but companies such as Victor was already targeting specific audiences. While Davis was at Louisiana College, touring groups from Victor regularly sang in the school's auditorium. Henry Burr often sang there. And so Davis was exposed to these people who were making money singing and making records. He was also exposed to Gene Austin, who grew up near Monroe, Louisiana, and Austin quickly became one of his favorites. Austin recorded My Blue Heaven and Ramona. When Davis made his first recordings in 1928, one of those songs was Ramona. But while Davis admired Austin's control and his sweet vocals, it was another voice that captivated him and the Southern people. The other voice Jimmy heard recorded, another song he recorded in his first session was A Way Out on a Mountain, a very close cover of the Jimmy Rogers second session for Victor. This was released in April of 1928, the Rogers recording. Davis covered it within 2 months. He went up to Wisconsin to record for the Hello World label, small label in Shreveport, and I'll play an example in a minute, and you'll be able to hear it's virtually exactly the same. Rogers was a top performer of hillbilly music during his lifetime, and his success proved to recording companies that this music was profitable. He spawned a generation of performers who began their career covering Rogers' tunes. Davis, in my opinion, is the best of the imitators, and this ability led Victor's agent, Ralph Peer, who signed, at this point Davis was clerk in the criminal court in Shreveport, to a contract. Peer also taught Davis the valuable art of copyright control. Davis told me that, among other things, Peer was excellent at writing a contract, and this is important when we study Davis. So why don't we go ahead and play? First we're going to hear Jimmy Rogers doing A Way Out on a Mountain, just the opening stanza, and then we'll hear Jimmy Davis doing it. The pianist is James Enlow, who briefly played with Paul Whiteman. I think it's on there.
I'll pack my trip for a farewell trip. Kiss Susie Jane goodbye at the fountain. I'm going, said I, to the land of the sky. Away out on the mountain, where the wild sheep go and the buffalo low. And the squirrels are so many you can't count them. Then I'll make love to some turtle dove way out on the mountain. Holy, 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 holy.
Okay, now this is Davis. This is a very rare recording.
I'll pack my grip for a farewell trip. Kiss Susie Jane goodbye at the mountain. I'm going to die to the land of the sky. Way out on the mountain, where the wild seas grow and the buffalo low. Then I'll make love to some turtle dove way out on the mountain. Lee-dee-lee, lee-dee-lee,
We can divide Davis's career into roughly 4 parts. The first period I've titled The Formative Years and represents some of his most interesting work. This is from about 1928 to 1940. During this period, Davis recorded in a wide range of styles, from Jimmy Rogers' blue yodels, example of which we've heard, although that wasn't a blue yodel in the numbered sense, the blackest and bluest of any records recorded by a white artist at the time. And he was backed by jazz bands, Hawaiian musicians, Western swing ensembles, and black street musicians. The years that Davis recorded for Victor, 1930 to 34, were highlighted by his risque blues. Songs such as Red Nightgown Blues, which comes with a supercharged nymphomaniac who rapes her fiance on the way to a wedding. Sewing Machine Blues, which we're gonna hear a piece of that in a minute. Where Davis asked St. Peter for a high-stepping brown if an angel isn't available. He also didn't like this cropping up when he was running as a segregationist in 1950. Organ grinder blues in which an impotent man extols the virtues of a monkey gland implant. These songs, Dr. Brinkley, who some of you may have heard of, was doing these operations. Anyway, the songs reveal a deep debt to black culture, especially black recordings, particularly those of the Hokum Boys in Chicago, a band which centered on Big Bill Brunzi, Tampa Red, and the great Georgia Tom Dorsey. The Hokum Boys specialized in risque numbers that were often covered by country musicians. For example, Western swing innovator Milton Brown covered several of their songs, and Milton was a very close friend of Davis. The blackness of these recordings was further emphasized by Davis's use of black street musicians Oscar Woods and Eddie Schaefer, who were from Shreveport. While the risque recordings are wonderful pieces of playing and singing, the heavy scholarly interest in them has obscured the fact that they are only one quarter of Davis's Victor's output. His risque recordings also were not limited to black Hokum songs. Keyhole in the Door is a very well-documented dirty song from the white tradition, which was common in the southern region of Arkansas, where Henry Davis lived for a short time. Thus, Davis' risque songs represent a wide tradition of dirty music that also existed in the white community. The bulk of the Victors were imitations of Jimmy Rogers and romantic love ballads. The songs were moderately successful in the Depression, given the circumstances. But Victor seems to have wanted really to turn Davis into another Rogers, and he balked at this. And as much as he admired Rogers, he wanted his own voice. And as a result, when his friend Jack Capp formed Decca Records in 1934, he quickly signed with them. We're going to hear now Sewing Machine Blues from 1932, recorded in Dallas. Davis being backed up by Oscar Woods and Eddie Schaefer. And then we're going to hear Where the Old Red River Flows, one of his more ballad-type songs, which might be the first country song to cast aspersions on New York City. I'm not sure, but it's really close to it if it's not. It's not Hank Jr., but it's a star. Remember, this is a man who was a segregationist. The next verse was the High Steppin' Brown verse, which he took from Blind Willie McTell.
Farm in Louisiana.
Davis also usually says Stephen Foster had an influence on him, and I think you can hear it in this song.
On my farm in Louisiana, where the old Red River flows, the lights are bright tonight on Broadway, and the big city's bright as day. On the beach at Coney Island, where the liquor makes you gay. But I'm
It's not Buck Owens, and I wouldn't live in New York City if they gave me the whole damn town. But maybe it's a story. Okay. Decca, as you all well know, was founded on the principle of making money by selling quality records at a low price, hoping that higher sales would offset the lower profit margin on each record. Cap seems to have permitted Davis some free rein in his recording style, and Jimmy continued to explore new styles, but increasingly he settled into one sound. The blue yodels and blues decreased significantly. The arrangements began to reflect the Western swing style emanating out of Dallas and Tulsa. For his Decca recordings, Davis drew heavily on the bands of his friends, Cliff Bruner and Milton Brown, leaders of two of the finest Western swing groups then performing. Now, Bruner and Brown didn't go the Bob Wills Spade Cooley route with the horns and so forth. They stayed sort of more of a string ensemble style, which began to suggest what would become honky-tonk music. Their style was smooth and perfectly complemented Davis and his often pop leanings. Thus, he consciously chose musicians who could perform hillbilly songs that would have a little pop flair. The recordings for Decca made during this period reveal a high degree of technical strength, found, in my opinion, there are very few bands that rival the ones that Davis was playing with during this time. The musicians were just excellent. The sound is tight, it never sounds forced. Since he almost never used his own band for recording, maybe he was creating his own perfect band by picking from his friends, and maybe this is sort of the Nashville sound in advance. We're gonna have a studio band of excellent musicians. I'm not sure, it's just a thought. By 1940, Davis entered the second period. So before we get to that, I want to play two songs. Davis's first national hit, 1934, Nobody's Darling But Mine. And then we're going to hear High Gear Daddy, one of the last of the risque songs from this period, which he recorded with Milton Brown's Musical Brownies shortly after Milton's tragic death.
Sit by my side, little darling. Come lay your cool hand on my brow.
Y'all recognize this?
Promise me that you will never be nobody's darling but mine. Nobody is darling but mine, love. Be honest, be faithful, be kind. Promise me that.
My grandfather said that this was a great courting song in the 1930s. He said it was really, really nice to sing to your girlfriend.
But mine.
Okay, and then this is High Gear Daddy with the Brownies.
I just come down from across the slough. I'm a true loving daddy and I just won't do. I'm a high gear daddy, I don't care what I do.
Well, come on, mama, let's strut our stuff. I'm a true loving daddy, and I never had enough. I'm a high gear daddy, I don't care what I do.
Bob Dunn. Everybody needs to know that name. If you go to the Hall of Fame tomorrow, you'll see his steel there. Look at it, it's wonderful.
You got to ride me high. I'm a high gear daddy.
That verse was actually picked up by Danny Barker, the great jazz man, and he actually wrote a song called Don't You Feel My Leg. But this is the earliest recorded example of it that I know of. And I knew Danny, and Danny said, you know, Jimmy made some really good records that had some really raunchy stuff in them. He said, I listen to them all the time. So you got a nice cross of country going over into jazz in this regard. Those songs like High Gear Daddy, Red Nightgown Blues, Salty Dog, when Davis first ran for governor in 1934, his opponents used these against him. And in Shreveport, Jimmy Morrison, still alive, a wonderful cat, politician, longtime U.S. representative from Louisiana, was running against Davis. And he went to Shreveport and he advertised that he was going to have a rally to show people what kind of a man Jimmy Davis was. He was lewd and all these things. And he said, I'm going to play you these records. Don't bring your wives and preachers don't come because this is horrible. If you do come, realize what you're getting into. Well, the story goes that Morrison had a huge Victrola and he started playing the records and people started to dance, including preachers. And the story is that Morrison was so infuriated that he picked up the Victrola and launched it out into the crowd, shouting, well, if you like it, elect the son of a bitch. Which they did. I got to tell one more story on Jimmy Morrison. Trying to compete with Davis, he hired a French band, Leo Swallow's Aces. And they were traveling with him, and Crawford Vincent told me a wonderful story that Leo needed money, so he played with Morrison, but he supported Jimmy Davis in his heart. So Swallow, being French, when he was in South Louisiana, would get up in front of the audience and in French say, now we're going to play a song by my friend Jimmy, and I want you to remember him on election day, and please cast your vote. Now Morrison didn't understand French, so he only heard Jimmy and something that he thought was election day. And so he was happy. And then Swallow would sing You Are My Sunshine or Columbus Stockade Blues or Nobody's Darling, all of which he translated into French. So he was plugging Davis at Morrison's rally, and Morrison didn't even realize. So whenever musicians, politicians attacked Davis on his music, they often lost ground because it was hard to win. By 1940, Davis had entered what we might call his sunshine period after his most famous song. The Davis style gelled around a string band, lead and rhythm guitars, fiddle played in the Longbow Texas style, string bass, and a piano or accordion, and a muted cornet often appears. Basically, this was an early honky-tonk band. Davis didn't create this. This was happening in Texas. Al Dexter, for example, had a similar band. But Davis did a lot to popularize this lineup. His vocals dominated these recordings. He also began to record monologues and recitations, inserting them in his songs. This seems to be something he and Milton begin to develop together. Davis's spoken voice was just as expressive as his singing voice, and the recitations add strength to his recordings. We're going to hear Sweethearts Are Strangers from 1940. This is one of my favorite Davis songs.
Sweethearts are strangers, it makes no difference now. I leave it up to you. Sweethearts are strangers, I'll get along somehow. What do you want to do? I guess I'll always love you, no matter what you say. By all the stars above you, we can't go on this way. Sweethearts are strangers, how do we go from here? Sweethearts are strangers, dear.
I've received several letters from just fans who know that I'm writing on Davis. And one of the most common remarks they make is his use of the cornet or the trumpet. They really love that. And I didn't really notice it at first, but because of talking to fans, I began to realize this meant a lot to people. I think this is Moon Mulligan on piano, I'm not sure.
Sweethearts are strangers, what may the verdict be? That's what you must decide. Sweethearts are strangers, don't worry about me. I've loved, I've laughed, I've cried. I guess I'll always own you, although you say we're through. I'm glad that I have known you, though my heart breaks in two. Sweethearts are strangers, how do we go from here? Sweethearts are strangers, dear.
It doesn't get much better than that, in my opinion. That's classic Davis. His songwriting also blossomed during this period. His lyrics tended to be what we call tearjerkers. He liked those sad romance songs. Occasionally he'd do an up-tempo number like Mama's Getting Hot, Papa's Getting Cold. But most of them were songs like what you just heard. He maintained a close working relationship with some of the finest songwriters of the period, Floyd Tillman and Ted Daffin, also Shelley Lee Alley, whose papers are over at the Hall of Fame, a wonderful resource. These relationships have led to some very vexing questions of authorship. Davis often purchased songs from fellow songwriters and signed on as co-writer. This was a common practice. Generally, Ted Daffin, who I've spoke to about it, didn't express very many regrets about it. He said it helped him get his feet in the door. Floyd Tillman's a little more reluctant over this. But Davis was still buying songs as late as 1989, when I have documentation of one set. And the Alley papers are fantastic for that, because you actually see a purchase of a song by Davis going on in those papers. To Davis's credit, he only signed on as co-author most of the time. And he usually gave up rights when they came up for copyright renewal. Anyway, which brings us to You Are My Sunshine. Everybody knows You Are My Sunshine. One of the most valuable copyrights ever, period, okay? Davis says, well, I can eat a few hamburgers on it. No. I visited him and I found this little thing you stick in a roll of toilet paper and it plays You Are My Sunshine when you roll it out. And I gave it to him and actually they hadn't cleared the copyright on it. So he did tell me, he said, maybe I owe you a buck or two, which I'll never see. But You Are My Sunshine, Davis did not write, I think we can say. He purchased it from Paul Rice, who did not write it. You Are My Sunshine appears to have been a folk song that emerged in northern Georgia, western South Carolina in the 30s. And I think it's a good example of what the commercial system did with folk songs. I mean, it was brand new, and it was snacked immediately. and brought into the commercial world. Most people say Davis didn't write it at all. He had nothing to do with it. I'm not so sure. The most I've ever gotten out of Davis is this. Charlie Mitchell and I had these verses, and we were playing around with them, and we came up with You Are My Sunshine. Well, I don't know what shape the verses were in. Maybe they did polish it into the song that we now know. But I do know this. If there was no Jimmy Davis, we probably wouldn't know You Are My Sunshine, because he pushed it. He got it to Bing Crosby. He got it to Gene Autry, whose versions were better than his first recorded version. He got it to Guy Lombardo. And so everyone knew the song through his efforts. So in that sense, You Are My Sunshine is his song, and it can't be taken away from him. And I don't begrudge him that. By the late 40s, Davis's career was on the downturn. The more earthy honky-tonk sound of people like Hank Williams was very popular, as opposed to Davis's sort of smoother style. He was older. He had served 4 years in the Louisiana governor's chair, and it kept him from the cutting edge of music. By 1950, he was on the radio broadcasting the Fill Up with Billups show. Billups was a chain of gas stations run by Buddy Billups, a very wealthy Louisiana oil magnate who was also one of the major Davis political contributors. People would write in and ask Davis to sing religious music. And Davis, whose career was going down, said, hey, maybe I can make money selling religious music. And he did. In the early 1950s, he began to sing gospel music. Until this time, gospel music had been largely dominated by quartets and family singing. But people like Jimmy Davis and Red Foley and Martha Corson began to bring a individual star system to the music. Davis shifted his publishing firmly into gospel.
To play till evening shadows come, then winding down an old familiar pathway, I heard my mother call at set of sun. Come home, come home, it's supper time. The shadows lengthen fast. Come home, come home, it's supper time. We're going.
Some of the fondest memories of my childhood were woven around supper time, when my mother used to call from the back steps of the old home place, come on home now, Jim, it's supper time. Oh, gee, but I'd love to hear that once more. But you know, for me, time has woven the realization of a truth that is even more thrilling. And that's when the call comes from the portals of glory to come home, for it's supper time. When all of God's children shall gather around the table with the Lord himself, the greatest supper time of them all.
This from a man who also sang
Come Home, It's Supper Time,
Red Nightgown Blues, and could sing the praises of God in a nymphomaniac. I mean, what more do you want? I
Come home, come home, it's supper time.
In the late 50s and early 60s, Davis's music, it began to get into a rut. He produced some very good gospel music, excellent sides, for example, Someone to Care. But he was trapped in the Nashville sound. And I just finished yesterday running his discography from 1958 to 1982. There's virtually no change in the Sidemen in that whole time period. It's all Owen Bradley's, Bradley Bourne people, the same names over and I just began to write their initials because I knew who they were. So the music, it's good, but it begins to lose interest for me anyway. By the late 60s, Davis was not the star that he had once been. He was doing the bluegrass festival circuit in the 70s. He married his second wife, Anna Carter Gordon, of the Chuckwagon Gang, and they began to sing together. And he moved to a combo of guitar and piano, and he emphasized harmony with his wife. More and more, it was gospel music. And then something happened in the late 80s. Jimmy Davis, always able to smell trends, began to see that country music in the 80s had sort of gotten back to the people like George Strait and Ricky Skaggs were going back to traditional music, traditional recorded music. And Davis, I think, saw this. And ever so slowly, more and more of those old songs from the 40s began to creep into his performances. Gospel music started to slip away, except when he sang at churches, of course. By 1994, Davis was entering what might be the fourth period of his career, a return to country music. His Jazz Fest performance that year featured only two gospel songs, if I remember correctly. He had a new disc out, a new risque song, this one quite playful, called the Ding Dong Song. And the next year, at his 95th birthday party, at a $100 a plate dinner, he reassembled that sound from Sweethearts or Strangers. He didn't have a trumpet, though. And so maybe as country music has sort of can't come back, Jimmy Davis smelled the trend and went back once again. I'm not sure. Anyway, I hope this discussion will help you realize that far from being just a purveyor of dirty songs, a questionable copywriter, Jimmy Davis has been a major figure in country music. We can use his career to gauge the changes in the music and so forth. He helped to initiate trends, but he also followed, always guided by this uncanny ability to move in exactly the right direction. As a result, his is the longest and one of the most successful careers in the music industry, period. His first recordings were in 1928, remember this, and he was 28 at the time. And he is the only protege of Jimmy Rogers who has not only issued his work on compact disc, he's recorded new songs for it, as far as I know. Indeed, he is one of our last living links to the father of country music and a world of music that still speaks to us every time the needle drops into the groove. And I'd like to play one more selection from 1959, You're My Sunshine. I think Davis's best version of it. From an album released, I think, about a month before he announced his second run for governor. So I think he figured, you know, hey, some stereo recordings might get me back on the jukeboxes. Go ahead. This is produced by Owen Bradley.
The other night, dear, as I lay sleeping, I dreamed I held you in my arms. But when I woke, dear,
I learned this song.
Mistaken.
It's the first song I can remember, and I learned it from the French's Mustard commercial. Y'all remember that? It's the first that and the other song that I remember is sort of a psychedelic Cajun song called Opelousas Sostan, which some of you may know, but it's very interesting.
You never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away.
Yes, sir, folks, I want to tell you something and tell you for sure. You know there's not much that old sunshine won't cure. So when you're down and you're feeling kind of low, why just step right out in its golden glow. Try not to worry and don't ever whine. Yes, some of my good friends and neighbors, all you got to do is just take a little bit, just a spoonful, of that good old-timey sunshine.
You can cut it right there.
I'll always love you.
Okay.
And make you
happy.
If
you'll have any questions, I'll be happy to answer. Thank you. I also do weddings and bar mitzvahs. I don't have one on here. The last thing I know that he recorded was Ding Dong Song.
I'd love to hear him
do it. He's still alive. He's 98 or 99. We're not sure when he was born. And he still tours. He still puts out records. He still controls his copyrights and everything. He's an amazing individual. If anyone's interested, I have a little sheet that I did on available compact disc, which is now horribly out of date, but it's still a guide to what the best compact discs that are out there. Thank y'all.
Do you wanna take this?
One quick reminder, the Songwriters Night that we have scheduled here in the ballroom is 8 o'clock. Between now and 8, I understand there's some good live music in the area. If you're in doubt, ask Chuck. He seems to know. And a chance to grab dinner, and we'll see you guys back here at 8. Thanks.